thing. You taught me how to read, she countered. I borrowed a book. Coiled again and arched and stretched. Promise. Open. Hold back nothing, she said. That is your duty. Denial shattered. Self-discipline vanished with the wind. Rao moved like a panther to his mate. In the corridors beyond the chamber, servant women waited. Older women in the main, Marathas all. When they heard Shakuntala's wordless voice announcing her defloration, they grinned. In another virgin, there might have been some pain in that cry. But for their fierce empress, there had been nothing beyond ecstasy and eager desire. The thing was done. The pledge fulfilled, the promise kept. The women scurried through the halls, spreading the word. But their efforts were quite needless. Shakuntala had never been a bashful girl. Now, becoming a woman, she fairly screamed her triumph. The young men heard, waiting in the streets below. They had mounted their horses before the servants reached the end of the first corridor. By the time Maharashtra's women emerged onto the streets to tell the news, Maharashtra's sons and nephews had already left. By the time the dancing resumed and the revelry began, they were carrying the message out of the gates and pounding it on flying horse-borne feet in every direction. The land called Maharashtra had been created millions of years earlier when the Earth's magma boiled to the surface. The Deccan Traps, geologists of a later age would call it, solemnly explaining to solemn students that it had been perhaps the greatest and most violent volcanic episode in the planet's history. Now, while Deagiri danced its glee, the great country began its new eruption. Dancing with swift and spreading steps, the new time for Malwa, the time of death and terror and desperate struggle. Malwa's soldiers already detested service in Maharashtra. From that day forward, they would speak of it in hushed and dreading tones, much like soldiers of a later army watching evil spill its intestines would speak of the Russian front. Belisarius had planned and schemed and maneuvered and acted, guided by Aid's vision of the Peninsular War. He already had his Peninsular War. Now he got the Pripyat Marshes and the Maquis and the Warsaw Ghetto and the mountains cupping Dien Bien Phu and the streets of Budapest and every other place in the history of the species where empires, full of their short-memoried arrogance, learned again the dance of time. Time, of course, contains all things. Among them is farce. Shakuntala's eyes were very wide. The young woman's face slack with surprise. I thought it would, I don't know, take longer. Looking down on that loving, confused face from a distance of inches, Rao flushed deep embarrassment. I can't believe it, he muttered. I haven't done that since I was 14. Awkwardly, he groped for words. Well, he fumbled. Well, it should have, actually. Much longer. He took a breath. How to explain? Halting words followed, speaking of self-discipline too suddenly vanished, excessive eagerness, a dream come true without sufficient emotional preparation, and... When Shakuntala finally understood, which didn't take long, in truth, she was inexperienced but very intelligent, though it seemed like ages to Rao, she burst into laughter. So, she cried. He had trained her to wrestle, also. In an instant, she squirmed out from under him and had him flat on his back. And straddling him, she began her chastisement.
So?
Playfully, she punched his chest.
The truth is out.
Punch.
Champion. Hero.
Punch.
I've been defrauded. Cheated.
Rao was laughing himself now. The laughs grew louder and louder as he heard his wife bestow upon him new cognomens of ridicule and ignominy. The Pant of Maharashtra. The gust of the great country. No, the puff of the great country. Laughter drove out shame and brought passion to fill the void. Soon enough, very soon, the Empress ceased her complaints. And by the end of a long night, allowed, regally magnanimous for all the sweat, that her husband was still her champion. Chapter 41. The Strait of Hormuz. Autumn, 532 AD. The monster fled ruin and disaster. Licking its wounds, trailing blood, dragging its maimed limbs, the beast clawed back toward its lair. Silent for all its agony, its cold mind preoccupied with plans for revenge. Revenge and an eventual return to predation. A different monster would have screamed from fury and frustration as much as pain and fear. But that was not this monster's way. Not even when the hunter who had maimed it sprang again from ambush. No, for a moment, there might have been a gleam of hatred somewhere deep inside those ancient eyes. Chapter 42. Belisarius started to speak, then closed his mouth.
Good. Good, murmured Usanas.
The Akabate Sensen glanced slyly at Antonina. She returned the look with a sniff. My husband is an experienced general, she proclaimed. My husband is calm and cool on the eve of battle. Usanas chuckled.
So it seems. Though for a moment there I would have sworn he was about to tell experienced sea captains how to maneuver a fleet.
Belisarius never took his eyes off the approaching flotilla of Malwa vessels, but his crooked smile did make an appearance. What nonsense, he said firmly. The idea is absurd. He turned his head, speaking to the man standing just behind him. Isn't it, Morris? Morris scowled.
Of course it is. You'd spend 10 minutes before you got into it telling Gersom which way the wind's blowing, after spending half an hour explaining what sails are for.
It's the general's curse, muttered Belisarius. Surly subordinates.
After spending 2 hours describing what wind is in the first place, continued Morris, and 3 hours...
He stuck out a stubby finger pointing to the sea around them.
Oh, Gersom, look! That stuff's called water!
Usanas and Antonina burst out laughing. Belisarius, for all his ferocious frown, was hard-pressed not to join them. After a moment, however, the amusement faded. They were hunting a monster, after all, and they were no longer lurking in ambush, hidden in a blind. Behind him, Belisarius heard Morris sigh.
All right, the Kiliarch muttered. Fair's fair. You were right again, General. But I still don't know how you figured it out.
I didn't figure it out, exactly. It was a guess, that's all. But we had nothing to lose except wasting a few days here in the Strait while the rest of the cargo ships carried the troops to Adulis. Belisarius pointed north, sweeping his finger in a little arc. They were well into the Strait of Hormuz now. The Persian mainland was a dim presence looming beyond the bow of the huge cargo vessel. That's about the worst terrain I can think of to try to march any army through without a reliable supply route. Any size army, much less that horde Lynx got. Morris snorted.
Not much of a horde now, not after we got done with them.
Belisarius shook his head. Don't fool yourself, Morris. We inflicted terrible casualties on them, true, and God knows how many died in the final destruction of the city. But I'm quite sure 2/3 of the Malwa army is still intact. He grimaced slightly. Well, alive, anyway. Intact is putting it too strongly. He paused, studying the oncoming Malwa vessels. There were 6 ships in that little flotilla. The 5 galleys which had avoided the Ethiopians in the delta were escorting a cargo ship. That vessel, though it was larger than the galleys, was far smaller than the huge ship Belisarius was standing upon. The general interrupted his own discourse. Leaning back from the rail, he shouted a question toward Gersom. The Aksumite commander was perched in the very bow of the ship, bestowing his own intense scrutiny on the enemy. 300 tons, Belisarius, came the reply. Probably the largest ship they had left. Belisarius chuckled, seeing Gersim's scowl. The Malwa vessel had been used as a supply ship on the Euphrates. The Ethiopian, a seaman, was half outraged at the idea of using such a craft for a river barge. And he was already disgruntled, having been forced to captain this great, ugly, clumsy, ungainly Malwa vessel, instead of one of the Ethiopian warships which formed the rest of his fleet. Belisarius returned to the subject. Link has to try to save as many of those soldiers as it can, Morris. It can save a few of them, they'll be yet tied to a man, by using what's left of the supply ships on the river. But the only way to salvage the main forces is to use the supply fleet at Barracucha, waiting for the westbound monsoon. 30 ships, according to the report Antonina got from Irene. Irene wrote that report just before she left Supara not many days ago. The ships were already loading provisions. Mention of Irene's report brought a moment's silence, as the four people standing at the rail joined in a heartfelt smile of relief, delight, and bemusement. Relief that they knew Irene was still alive to write reports, delight at the report itself, and bemusement at the workings of fate. Irene had written that report more out of sentiment than anything else. The odds of getting it into Antonina's hands were well nigh astronomical. But why not? There were no secrets in the report, after all, to keep from Malwa, and the captain of the Ethiopian smuggling ship had sworn, scoffing, that he could get the message through the Malwa blockade and back to Aksum. Whether it would ever reach Antonina, of course, he couldn't promise. In the event, that smuggler's ship had encountered the Ethiopian flotilla waiting at the strait to ambush Link. The message had found its way into Antonina's hands the day before. I'd like to have been at that wedding, mused Belisarius, just to finally see Rao dance right before me. He closed his eyes for a moment. He had seen Rao dance, but only in a vision. In another time, in another future, Belisarius had spent 30 years in Rao's company. He admired the Maratha chieftain, imperial consort now, perhaps more than any other man he had ever known. And so for a moment he savored Rao's joy at being, finally in this turn of the wheel, united with his soul's treasure. Antonina spent that moment savoring another's joy. Irene was her best friend. She'd been able to discern a subtle message contained within a depiction of political and military developments. Kungus had figured a bit too prominently in those sober sentences, quite a bit too prominently, measured in sheer number of words. And why in the world would Irene glowingly take the trouble to describe an illiterate's progress at his books? Uncertain, not knowing the man herself, Antonina had raised her suspicions with Belisarius. Her husband, once he realized what she was hinting at, had immediately burst into laughter. Of course, he'd exclaimed. It's a match made in heaven. Then, seeing her doubting face, trust me, love. If there's a man in the world who wouldn't be intimidated by Irene, it's Kungus. As for her, shrugging, laughing, you know how much she loves a challenge. The moment passed soon enough. Within an hour, they would be in battle again. So what would Link do, Morris? Would it send subordinates to organize the supply effort while it led the march back to India? Belisarius shook his head. I didn't think that likely. No, I was almost sure Link would want to get to India itself as fast as possible. Why else hold back the surviving galleys at the last minute in the Battle of the Delta? One of them, certainly. Perhaps two. That would have been enough to send subordinates with a message. He pointed at the cargo ship nestled among the Malwa galleys. They were less than 2 miles away. He was smiling, not like a man, but like a wolf smiles, seeing a fat and crippled caribou. That, my friends, is not a subordinate ship. That is the best Link could do, replacing Great Lady Holy's luxury barge in Kaushambi. The smile vanished completely. Nothing was left beyond pure ferocity. I own that monster now. Finally. Belisarius' quiet, seething rage brought hidden, half-conscious thoughts to the surface. For the first time, Aid realized Belisarius' full intentions, sooner perhaps than Belisarius did himself. No, he cried. You must not. It will kill you. Belisarius started. There had been sheer panic in that crystalline voice.
What's wrong, Aid?
Forcefully. We're not going to have this argument again. I've led charges in battle often enough. That was different. You were fighting men, not a cyborg. Men who wanted to live as much as you. Life means nothing to Link, not even its own. Long minutes followed while Belisarius waged a fierce argument with Aid. His companions, from experience, understood the meaning of his silence and his unfocused eyes. But as the minutes passed, they grew concerned, none more so than Antonina. Not since they first encountered Aid and he transported Belisarius into a vision of future horror had she seen her husband spend so much time in that peculiar trance. When he finally emerged, his face was bleak. Bleak, but bitterly determined. Belisarius pointed to the Malwa cargo ship in which, if he was correct, Link was waiting. The ship was not more than a mile distant now. Already Kshatriyas were erecting rocket troughs on the deck. There is something you should know. Aid just explained it to me. There is a reason the new gods chose women as the vessels for Link. Great Lady Holy today, if she dies, Link will be transferred into the person, the body, I should say, of her niece, Sati. She is probably still in Kaushambi. If Sati dies, there will be another girl in that same line, somewhere in Kaushambi also, in all likelihood. He paused, groping for a way to translate Aid's concepts. The effort was hopeless. Words like genetics and mitochondrial DNA would mean nothing to his companions. He barely understood them himself. He waved his hand. Never mind the specifics. Link is part machine, part human. The machine part, the core of it, is somewhere in India, probably in Kaushambi also. Its consciousness is passed upon her death from one woman to her successor. The new Link, once it's activated, let's call it, has all the memories of the old one up till the time she last... Again, he groped for words. Communicated with the machine. He paused. Morris eagerly filled the void. You know what that means? He demanded. The Kiliarch gripped the rail fiercely, glaring at the enemy ship. What it means, he hissed, is that if we kill that old bitch, the Malwa will be thrown into complete confusion. The new Link... What's her name? Sati? Won't know what's happened since Holy left. That's been a year and a half now. It'll take her months, months to get things reorganized. He turned from the rail, eager. Eager. God, General, that's perfect. We need that time ourselves. Sure, we won this battle, but our troops are exhausted too. We need to refit and hook back up with the Gathias and the Persians, and send another mission to Maharashtra and... He stumbled to a halt. Morris finally saw the other side of the thing. Antonina had understood at once. Her face was pale. You can't board that ship. Link will commit suicide. It has no reason not to. It's not human. It's just a vessel, a tool. She almost gasped. It'll want to. The last thing it can afford is to be captured. All of them now understood the implication. So why not take its enemy with it? It'll have that ship rigged, muttered Morris. Doing it right now, probably. Ready to blow up once you're aboard. Antonina ignored him. She was pale. Pale. She knew that expression on Belisarius' face. Knew it all the better because it was so rare. I don't give a damn, he snarled. I've been fighting that monster for 4 years. I'm tired of tactics and strategy. I'm just going to kill it. Protest began to erupt until a new voice spoke. Of course we will, boomed Usanas. Nothing to it. All eyes fixed upon him. The Akabe Tsensen grinned. Under other circumstances, of course, the deed would be insane. Foolish. Suicidal. He shrugged. But you forget. You have me. He began prancing around, lunging with his spear. Terrible. A demon. Antonina was not amused this time. She began to snarl a response until she suddenly realized Usanas wasn't prancing any longer. He was simply smiling, as serene as an icon.
No, Antonina, he said softly. I am not joking with you now. It is a simple fact.
Again, he shrugged,
that I am the best hunter I know.
He pointed his finger at Link's ship.
Not more than half a mile away now. Think clearly and logically. The monster cannot possibly have enough gunpowder to blow up the entire ship. It would only have brought defensive weapons, rockets, grenades. It will set them to destroy its own cabin after the boarding party arrives. That will take time.
He hefted his huge spear as lightly as if it were a mere twig.
Underneath, I think. Somewhere in the hold.
He turned to Belisarius.
You are determined, I imagine, to lead the boarding party yourself?
Belisarius's only answer was a snarl. Usanas nodded.
Do it, Roman. Take your best men. I will see to the rest.
The argument still raged, but the issue was settled. Between them, Belisarius and Usanas beat down all protest. Not even Anastasius, not even when ordered by Morris, was prepared to stop the general. He remembered Valentinian unyielding on a mountainside in Persia. He knew that the champion's own general this day would do no less. By then, the Ethiopian warships were already engaging the Malwa escort galleys. The battle was not quite as swift as that in the Delta, not quite. The Malwa had seen the Dieklus and tried to avoid it. But while their caution prolonged the outcome, it didn't change it. It simply made it the more certain. In less than 10 minutes, the 5 galleys had been boarded and their crews slaughtered. The Ethiopians lost only one of their craft to ramming. Even then, they were able to rescue the entire crew before the ship finally foundered. Belisarius, however, observed none of it. He'd been engaged throughout in a new argument, which he lost just as surely and inevitably as he had won the first. All right, he growled, glaring at his wife. Then, heaving a great sigh, but you stay behind, Antonina, do you hear? I won't have you in the front line. Her stubborn look faded, replaced by an insouciant smile. Well, of course, I had no intention of leading the charge. A very delicate snort. The whole idea is ridiculous. Unladylike. Chapter 43. The monster waited, patiently, with the sureness of eternal life. Not its own, that was meaningless, but that of its masters. Everything was finished now, except revenge. The deck of the ship was a carrion eater's paradise. Firing from the height of their own huge craft, with those powerful bows, the cataphracts had swept all life away. The Kshatriyas at the rocket troughs and their Yetai guards were nothing but ripped meat. No loss. The rocket volleys in the short time they lasted had been futile. The enormous vessel upon which the monster's great enemy came had simply shrugged off the missiles. There hadn't been many to shrug off in any event. Most of the rockets had been taken into the hold. They would soon be put to better use. The monster waited, satisfied. Next to it, squatting by the throne, an assassin held the gong which would give the signal to the priests waiting below. The creature, like the priests and the special guards, was a devotee of the monster's cult. The assassin, when the monster gave the order, would do his duty without fail. The monster waited. Cold. Cold. But perhaps somewhere in those depths glowed an ember of hot glee. The monster had been fighting its great enemy, its tormentor, for 4 years. Today, finally, it was going to kill it. The monster idled away the time in memory. It remembered the trickery at Gwalior and the cunning which crushed Nika. It remembered an army broken at Anatha and another destroyed at the Nahar Malka. It remembered the catastrophe at Karax. Come to me, Belisarius. Come to me. Chapter 44. Silently, Usanas crept through the hold, watching for the guards. Listening for the guards, more precisely. The hold was as dark as a rainforest on a moonless night. Usanas had waited for the sun to go down before he entered the hatch leading into the hold from the ship's bow. The horizon was still aglow with sunset colors, but none of that faint illumination reached into the ship's interior. There had been guards waiting by the entrance, of course. Two, hidden among the grain carrying amphorae, lashed against the hull. Excellent assassins, both of them. Usanas had been impressed. Before the feet of the Yetai corpses even touched the deck of the hull, the assassins had been there, knives flashing. The blades had penetrated the gaps in the corpses' Roman armor with short precision. Excellent assassins. They had realized the truth with their first stabs from feel alone. They were already withdrawing the wet blades by the time Usanas dropped the rope holding the corpse upright and leapt through the hatch. But that was too late. Much too late. Usanas crushed the first assassin's skull with a straight thrust of his spear butt's iron ferrule. The blade did for the other. He left the spear with them, still plunged into an assassin's chest. It would be knife work from here on. The hold was cramped, full of amphorae and sacks of provisions. No room there for Rosanus' huge spear. He waited for a few minutes, crouched in the darkness, listening. There should have been a third guard somewhere nearby, to support the two at the entrance if need be. Nothing. Rosanus was a bit surprised, but only a bit. The finest military mind in the world had predicted as much. Usanas smiled. It was a cold smile, but in the darkness there was no one to see that murderous expression. Link's assassins were the ultimate elite in Malwa's military forces, and therefore, just as Belisarius had estimated, suffered from the inevitable syndrome of all Praetorian guards. Deadly, yes, but also arrogant, too sure of themselves, scornful of their opponents. Well-trained, yes, but training is not the same thing as combat experience. Those assassins hadn't fought a real opponent in years. As Praetorian guards have done throughout history, they had slipped from being killers to murderers. Usanas started moving again. Slowly, very slowly. He was in no hurry. Belisarius would wait until Usanas gave the signal. The Roman general and his companions were perched on the stern, far from the cabin amidships. If the explosive charges went off, they should be able to escape unharmed. Even wearing armor, they could stay afloat long enough for the Aksumite warships surrounding Link's vessel to rescue them. For Usanas himself, of course, things would be worse. Fatal, probably. The once and former hunter, now lieutenant to the King of Kings, cared not in the least. He'd become a philosophical man over the years, but he had always been a killer. He had walked alongside death's shadow since he was a boy. Usanas had his own scores to settle. He had admired King Caleb for all that he never spoke the words. Aeon's father had possessed none of his son's quick wit. Still, he had been a good king, and Usanas had been very fond of Tarabai and Zaya and many of the people crushed in the stones of the Ta'aka Mariam. Your turn, Malwa. Black death crept through the hold. Two more murderers died by a killer's blade.
I'll go first, General, stated Anastasius.
The giant's heavy jaws were tight, as if he were expecting an argument. Belisarius smiled. By all means. I'm bold, but I'm not crazy. Link's guards are about the size of small hippos. Anastasius sneered.
So am I.
He hefted his mace. Huge muscles flexed under armor.
But I haven't spent the last few years wallowing in the lap of luxury.
You will now, came Antonina's cheerful rejoinder. Of course, given your philosophical bent, I'm sure you're planning to give it all away. Anastasius grinned. When the Roman army seized Carax, they had also seized the Malwa pay chests, not to mention the small amount of gold, silver, and jewelry which that huge army's officers had collected. The riches had been left behind in Carax when Link's army marched out of the city. Needless to say, it had not been left behind when the Romans sailed out. Every soldier in Belisarius's army was now a wealthy man. Not measured by the standards of Roman senators, of course, but by the standards of Thracian, Greek, and Syrian commoners, not to mention Kushan war prisoners, They were filthy, stinking, slobbering rich. Belisarius was a bit concerned about it, in fact. He would lose some of those veterans now, but he wasn't too concerned. Most of the veterans would stay, eager to share in the booty from future campaigns. And for every man who left, seeking a comfortable retirement, there would be 10 men stepping forward to take his place. Other Roman armies might have difficulty finding recruits, once the news spread. Belisarius's army would be turning them away. But that was a problem for the future. For now. There came a sound from below their feet. A faint clapping noise resounding through the hull, like a firecracker, perhaps.
"That's it," bellowed Anastasius.
A moment later, the huge cataphract was charging toward the cabin. Right behind him came Leo and Isaac, Priscus and Matthew. Belisarius and Antonina brought up the rear.
"Your turn, monster."
When Osanus finally reached his goal, he waited in the darkness only long enough to make sure he had a correct count of the opposition. The area of the hold amidships directly under Link's cabin had been hastily cleared of amphorae and grain sacks. In the small open area created, perhaps 10 feet square, 2 priests and an assassin were crouching. The area was lit by 2 small lamps. One of the priests was holding a cluster of fuses in his hands, the other a striker. The assassin's head was cocked, waiting for the signal to come from his master in the cabin above. For a moment, Usanas admired Malwa's ingenuity. He, like Belisarius, had thought they would disassemble the rockets and jury-rig explosive charges under the cabin. Link's minions had chosen pristine simplicity instead. True, there were grenades attached to the wooden underdeck. The fuses had been cut so short they were almost flush. But the rockets had simply been erected like so many small trees pointing directly upward. As soon as the fuses were lit, the cabin above would be riddled by 2 dozen missiles. The backblast from the rockets would ignite the grenades. There was no reason to wait. Silently, slowly, Usanas pulled the pin of his grenade. Then, with a quick and powerful flip of the wrist, he tossed the explosive device against the far wall of the hold. The grenade had been disassembled, its charge removed and then reassembled, but the impact fuse made a very satisfactory noise in the confines of the hold. Startled, the Mawa looked to the sound. The assassin realized the truth almost immediately, but almost facing a hunter like Usanas was not quick enough. The assassin's heart was ruptured by a Roman blade before he had his own dagger more than half raised. He did manage to gash the African's leg before he died. Usanas was quite impressed. The priests never managed more than a gasp. Usanas didn't take the time to withdraw the blade from the assassin's back. If Belisarius had been there watching, he would have seen an old suspicion confirmed. Usanas was stronger than Anastasius. Ekabe Tsensen simply seized the priests' necks, one in each hand, and crushed the bones along with the windpipes. Before he even lowered the bodies to the deck, Usanas could hear the thundering footsteps of the cataphracts charging the cabin. Then, the door splintering as Anastasius went through it like a hurricane. Then, the hunter was grinning now. As always, in darkness and gloom, those gleaming teeth seemed like a beacon.
"Goodbye, monster."
Anastasius was off balance when the first guard swung his tulwar. For that reason, he was unable to deflect the huge blade properly. Instead, his shield broke in half. The guard gaped. That blow should have flattened his opponent, if nothing else. The guard was still gaping when Anastasius's mace crushed his skull. Another guard swung a tulwar. Anastasius sidestepped the blow. Not as nimbly as Valentinian would have done, of course, but far more quickly than the guard would have ever imagined a man of Anastasius's size could move. Anastasius might have slain that guard easily with another stroke of the mace, but he wanted to create some fighting room in the confines of the cabin. He could see 4 more guards crowding behind, so instead he dropped his mace and seized the guard in a half-Nelson. Then, rolling his hip, he flung the man into his oncoming fellows. Quickly, Anastasius lunged aside, pressing himself against the wall of the cabin. He would retrieve his mace later. For now, he simply needed to let his companions pass. Leo came next through the shattered door, roaring like an ogre. Truth be told, Leo was almost as dim-witted as the nickname Ox implied. So, as always in battle, he eschewed complicated tactics. And why not? He never needed them before. He didn't need them this time, either. By the time Isaac and Priscus and Matthew forced their own immense and murderous bodies into the cabin, Leo had already killed one guard and disabled another. The rest died within half a minute. The battle, for all its fury, 11 huge men hacking and hammering each other in a room the size of a small salon, was as one-sided as any Belisarius had ever seen. He wasn't surprised. Watching from the doorway, Antonina peeking around his arm, Belisarius witnessed one of the few battles which went exactly according to plan. He had known it would. Anastasius was the only Roman who matched the size of Link's special guards, but the others matched them in strength, if not in sheer bulk. And they, unlike the guards, were not a pampered elite. They were the real thing. Swords and maces wielded on battlefields and the cruel streets of Carax went through the tulwars like fangs through soft flesh. Silence, except for the ringing gong held in an assassin's hands. Then silence, as Matthew's sword decapitated the gong holder. Belisarius stepped into the room, staring at Link. The monster was dying now. With its inhuman intelligence, Link had already assessed the new reality. There would be no rockets coming through the floor, killing its great enemy. No grenades to obliterate what might be left. Link had prepared for that possibility, so it had taken its last pitiful revenge. A jeweled cup slid out of the monster's hand. The body of an old woman, the monster's sheath, was already slumping in the ornate, bejeweled chair. An old woman's head lolled to the side. It was a quick-acting poison, but there was still a gleam in those wizened eyes. A small gleam of triumph, perhaps. If nothing else, the monster's great enemy would not take its life. Antonina shoved Belisarius aside. She sprang forward, raising her ugly and ungainly and detested hand cannon. Trusted weapon, now. Fuck you, she screamed. Left hammer, rear trigger, fire. The first shot blew the monster's heart through its spine, spinning Antonina half around. She spun back in an instant. Fuck you. Right hammer, front trigger, fire. The second shot splattered the monster's brains against the far wall. Antonina landed on her butt, driven down by the cuirass. Her ass hurt. Her hands hurt. Her arms hurt. Her shoulders hurt. Her breasts hurt. She raised her head, grinning up at her husband. God, that feels great. Belisarius beamed proudly at his cataphracts. That's my lady, he announced. That's my lady. Epilogue. An interruption and a conclusion. The monster came to life. As the soul which had once inhabited a young woman's body was obliterated, the monster groped for consciousness. The moment of confusion was brief. Disaster was the first thought. There has been a disaster. The monster examined its memory with lightning speed. Nothing. All was going well. What could have happened? There came an interruption. Are you all right, Lady Satie? A woman, plump, young, rather pretty, was staring at the monster, her face full of concern. You seem ill, perhaps. Your eyes... The monster's thoughts, as always, raced with inhuman speed. In an instant, she had the interruption categorized. One of Lady Sati's maids, Indira was her name. She had developed a certain closeness with her mistress. That could be inconvenient. More interruptions might occur. The monster swiveled its head. Yes, the assassins were at their post. Kill her. By the time the knives ceased their flashing work, the monster's thoughts had reached a preliminary conclusion. Belisarius. No other explanation seems possible. There was no anger in the thought. There was nothing in the thought. A command and a choice.
Are you insane? Demanded Nandalal the moment he strode into Venandakatra's pavilion. Why have you not already begun the withdrawal?
The vile one clenched his jaws. Any other man but Nandalal, and the Emperor, of course, would be caned for using that tone of voice to the Guptri of the Deccaned. Caned, if he were lucky. But Venandakatra controlled his rage. Barely. He thrust a finger at the ramparts of Deagiri.
I will have that city, he screeched. Whatever else, I will take it.
Nandalal seized the vile one by his shoulder and spun him around. Venandakatra was so astonished,
no one may touch me,
that he stumbled, almost sprawling on the carpet. Then he did sprawl. Nandalal's slap across the face did for that. Physical power, partly. The Mawa Empire spymaster was a strong man, thick with muscle. But mostly, Venandakatra's collapse was due to sheer, utter shock. No one had ever laid hands on Lord Venandakatra. He was the Emperor's first cousin. But so was Nandalal. And the spymaster was in plain and simple fury.
You idiot, hissed Nandalal. You couldn't take Deagiri even when it was possible. Today?
Angrily, the spymaster pointed through the open flap of the pavilion. Beyond lay the road to Barakucha.
I had to fight my way here, you imbecile, with a small army of Rajputs.
He reached down, seized Venandakatra by his rich robes, and hauled him to his feet. There came another buffet, hard open palm across flabby cheek.
If you move now, fool, we can still extract your army with light casualties. By next week, the week after for a certainty, half your soldiers will be dead by the time you reach Barakucha.
Contemptuously, Nandalal released his grip. Again, Venandakatra collapsed to the carpet. His mouth was agape, his eyes unfocused. Nandalal turned away, clasping his hands behind his back.
We could hope to hold Barakucha and the line of the Narmada, the large towns in the North Deccan. That is all for the moment. But we must hold Barakucha. If it's lost, our army in Mesopotamia will starve.
His heavy jaws tightened. Nandalal opened his mouth as if to speak further, but simply shook his head. The spymaster wasn't prepared to share his still tentative analysis of the likely situation in Mesopotamia, his fears about Mesopotamia. Certainly not with Venandakatra.
Do it, he commanded.
He tapped the sash, holding his own robes in place. An imperial scroll was thrust into that sash.
I have the full authority here to do anything I wish. That includes ordering your execution, Venandakatra.
He turned his head, glowering down at the sprawled man at his feet. The scroll is not signed by the Emperor alone, by the way. It also bears Great Lady Sati's signature. Venandakatra's shock and outrage vanished instantly. His face, already pale, became ashen.
Yes, grated Nandalal. Great Lady Sati.
The spymaster looked to the northwest through the open flap.
Quietly. The siege of Deagiri is over, Venandakatra. By tomorrow morning, this army will be on the road to Barakucha. That is a given. The only choice you have is whether you will lead it, or simply your head stuck on a pike.
A desire and a decision.
Where do we stand with the new warships? Asked the King of Kings, striding into the room which served Aksum as its war center.
Rukaya looked up from her table in the center of the room. It was a large table, but little of its expanse was visible. Most of it was covered with scrolls and bound sheets of papyrus. The queen pointed to the sheet in front of her.
I was just finishing a letter to John of Rhodes, thanking him for the last shipment of guns. We have enough now to outfit the first two vessels.
Good. Good, grunted Aeon, coming up to the table. I want to get them out to sea at once so we can start ravaging the supply fleet as soon as it leaves Barakucha.
He leaned over and nuzzled his wife's hair. Smiling, she reached up and drew his head alongside her own.
There is more good news, she whispered.
Aeon cocked his eyebrow. Rukaya's smile widened.
They'll call him Wasi, of course, if it's a boy. But you really should start thinking about girls' names, too. A question and an answer.
Kungus rose from the bed and padded to the window. Planting his hands on the sill, he stared out over Deagiri. The city was dark except for the lamps glowing in one of the rooms of the nearby palace. His lips twitched.
It's a good thing for him that he has an understanding wife.
Irene levered herself onto an elbow.
What? Is Dadaji working late again?
Seeing the Kushan's nod, she chuckled.
Understanding is hardly the word for it, Kungus. She'll be sitting there herself, you know that, as patient as the moon.
Kungus said nothing. Irene studied him for a moment, reading the subtle signs in his face.
What is it, Kungus? She asked. You've been preoccupied with something all night.
Kungus tapped the windowsill with his fingers. Irene stiffened slightly. That was as close as the Kushan ever came to expressing nervous apprehension.
What is it? She demanded. And don't tell any fables. You've got the jitters, I know you do. Something which involves me.
Kungus sighed.
There are disadvantages, he muttered, to a smart woman.
He turned away from the window and came back to the bed. Then, sitting on the edge, he gave Irene a level stare.
Abruptly, I spoke to Kanishka and Kujulo today about Peshawar and my plans for the future.
She nodded approvingly. Kanishka and Kujulo were the key officers in the small army of Kushans serving Shakuntala. Irene had been pressing Kungus for weeks to raise the subject with them.
And? She asked, cocking her head.
They have agreed to join me. They said, on balance, that they thought I would make a good king.
Again, he sighed.
Nonetheless, they were critical. Rather harshly so, in fact. They feel that I have neglected the first requirement of a successful dynasty.
He looked away.
They are quite correct, of course. So I promised them I would see to the matter immediately, if possible.
Irene stared at him for a moment. Then she bolted upright, clutching the sheets to her chest.
What? She hissed. You expect me? Me? A Greek noblewoman accustomed to luxury and comfort to go traipsing off with you into the wilds of Central Asia? Squat in some ruins in the middle of mountains and deserts, surrounded by barbarian hordes and God knows what other dangers?
Her eyes were very wide.
Be a queen for a bunch of Kushan mercenaries with delusions of grandeur? Spend the rest of my life in a desperate struggle to forge a kingdom out of nothing?
Other than a slight tightening of his jaws, Kungus's face was a rigid mask.
I don't expect, he said softly. I am simply asking, hoping.
Irene flung her arms around his neck and dragged him down. Within a second, the huge, heavy bed was practically bouncing off the floor from her sheer energy. Quiver, shiver, quake, and shake.
Oh, Kungus, she squealed. We're going to have so much fun.
A reminder and a distinction. When he finished reading the letter from Emperor Skandagupta, Demoderate turned his head and stared at the Tigris. For a moment, his gaze followed the river's course north to Assyria and Anatolia and Constantinople beyond. Then for a longer moment, the gaze came to rest on his army's camp. It was a well-built camp. Solid, strong, almost a permanent fort after all the weeks of work.
That's it, then, he said softly. It's over.
He turned to the man at his side, folding the letter.
Prepare the army, Ranasanga.
We have been summoned back to India. The emperor urges great haste. Sanga nodded. He began to turn away, but stopped.
If I may ask, Lord, what is to be our new assignment?
Demoderous sighed heavily. Unrest is spreading all over India. The Deccan is in full revolt. Venandakatra has been driven back into Barakucha. He is confident that he can hold the city unaided, though he can't reconquer Maharashtra without assistance. That will end up being our task, no doubt.
But first we must subdue Bihar and Bengal while the Emperor rebuilds the main army. He expects the Romans to attack our northwest provinces within a year, 2 years at the outside. Sangha said nothing, but his face grew tight. It appears you will be meeting Raghunath Rao again someday, mused Damodara. After all these years, the bards and poets will be drooling. Damodara studied Sangha closely, then said very softly, "The day may come, Rana Sangha, may come, when I will have to ask you to remember your oath." Sangha's face, already tight, became as strained as a taut sheet. "I do not need to be reminded of honor, Lord Damodara," he grated harshly. Damodara shook his head. "I did not say I would ask you to honor your oath, Sangha. Simply to remember it." Sangha frowned. "What is the distinction?" There was no answer. After a moment, shrugging angrily, Sangha stalked off. Damodara remained behind, staring at the river. He found some comfort, perhaps, in the study of moving water. A concern and an explanation.
"I am your obedient servant, Lord," said Narses, bowing his head.
As soon as Damodara left the tent, Narses' face broke into a grin.
"We're on," he muttered, rubbing his hands.
Ajatashatru looked up from the chessboard.
"What are you so excited about?"
Narses stared at him. The grin faded, replaced by something which bordered on sadness.
"You have become like a son to me," said Narses abruptly.
Ajatashatru's face went blank. For a moment, no more. Then a sly smile came.
"That's not entirely reassuring, Narses. As I recall, the last time you adopted a spiritual offspring, you tried to murder her."
Narses waved his hand.
"Not right away," he countered. "Not for many years, in fact. Besides..."
The eunuch sat on the chair facing Ajatashatru. He stared down at the chessboard.
"Besides, the situation isn't comparable. She was an empress. You're just a poor adventurer."
Ajatashatru snorted. Narses glanced at the small chest in the corner of the tent.
"Well, relatively speaking."
The assassin crossed his arms over his chest and leaned back in the chair.
"Why don't you just come out with it, Narses? If you want to know my loyalties, ask."
The eunuch opened his mouth, closed it. Ajatashatru laughed quite gaily.
"Gods above, I'd hate to live in your mind. You just can't do it, can you?"
Narses opened his mouth, closed it. Ajatashatru, still chuckling, shook his head.
"Relax, old man. Like you said, I'm an adventurer, and I can't imagine anybody who'd provide me with more adventures than you."
Narses sighed.
"Thank you," he whispered.
His lips twisted wryly.
"It means a great deal to me, Ajatashatru, whether I'm capable of saying it or not."
Ajatashatru eyed the eunuch for a moment.
"I'm puzzled, though. Why the sudden concern?"
The assassin nodded toward the entrance of the tent.
"I didn't catch any of your conversation with Damodara, but I did hear his last sentence. You do not have my permission to do anything, Narses. That sounds pretty definite to me."
Narses cackled.
"What a novice! A babe in the woods!"
He leaned forward.
"You really must learn to parse a sentence properly, Ajatashatru. You do not have permission, my boy, does not mean the same thing as I forbid you."
Ajatashatru's eyes widened. Narses cackled again.
"It's mate in 6 moves, by the way,"
the eunuch added. A greeting and a grouse. There was not much left of Carax when Belisarius and Antonina returned from Adulis a few weeks later, but the Persians had managed to salvage enough of the docks for their ship to be moored.
Emperor Khusro was there to meet them, along with Berasminus, Carush, and Agathias. The Persians were beaming happily. Agathias was not. Politely, the Persians allowed Agathias to greet the general first. The Duke of Osrhoen limped forward, aiding his wooden leg and foot with a pair of crutches.
"Fine mess you left me," he grumbled the moment Belisarius came up to him.
Belisarius glanced around, frowning.
"What did you expect? You knew I was going to wreck the place."
"Not that," snorted Agathias. "It's all the irate letters I've been getting from the Empress. Theodora is demanding to know how I could have been so careless, letting the Persians get their hands on gunpowder technology."
"Oh, that."
Belisarius clapped Agathias on the shoulder.
"You covered for me, I trust."
Agathias shrugged.
"Sure, why not? I still know how to bake bread when I get cashiered in disgrace."
Gloomily.
"Assuming she lets me keep my head."
Belisarius turned to Antonina. "The two of you have never met, I believe. Antonina, meet one of my finest generals. Agathias, this is my wife. She is also, I might mention, Theodora's best friend." Agathias extended his hand.
"Well, it's certainly a pleasure to meet you."
A regret and a cheer. Much later that night, after Khusro and his entourage left, Belisarius stretched lazily.
"There's something to be said for having Persians as allies," he announced. His admiring eyes roamed about the lavishly furnished pavilion which the Aryan Emperor had provided for them.
Antonina grinned.
"Cut it out, soldier. Since when have you given a damn about luxuries? You just like the idea of Dagon's hammering away at somebody else, that's all."
Belisarius returned the grin with one of his own.
"True. True," he admitted. "Fills me with pure glee, it does, thinking about the Malwa trying to retreat with those mean bastards climbing all over them."
After a moment, his amusement faded. Within a very short time, it was gone completely.
"It's not your fault, love," said Antonina gently.
Belisarius blew out his cheeks.
"No, it isn't. And if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't hesitate for a minute, but..."
He sighed.
"Most of them are just peasants, Antonina. Not more than 20,000 will ever make it back to their families in India. Khusro and Carush will harry them mercilessly all the way back to the Indus Valley."
He rubbed his face. "And if Aeon's new warships can keep the Malwa from landing supplies on the coast, there won't even be 10,000 survivors."
"It's not your fault," said Aid.
Belisarius shook his head.
"That's not the point, Aid, Antonina. I'm not concerned with fault. Malwa is to blame for the death of their soldiers just as surely as they are for the crimes those soldiers committed while they were in Persia. No one else."
Hands curled into fists.
"It's just..."
Belisarius turned his head, staring into the flame of a lamp.
"It's just that there are times when I really wish I could have been a blacksmith."
Silence followed. A minute or so later, Morris came into the pavilion. The Kiliarch gazed on his general, still staring at the lamp.
"Indulging in the usual triumphal melancholy, are we?" he demanded.
Belisarius, not moving his eyes from the lamp, smiled crookedly.
"Am I really that predictable?"
Morris snorted. He advanced into the pavilion and placed a hand on Belisarius' shoulder.
"Well, cheer up, lad. I've got some good news. I'm expanding your bodyguard. You'll be leading a huge allied army on your next campaign. Gotta have a more substantial bodyguard. Nothing else, the Persians will be miffed if you don't."
Belisarius scowled.
"For the sake of Christ, Morris, if you give me a Persian-style bodyguard, I won't be able to see my hand in front of my face."
Morris chuckled.
"No, I wasn't thinking of anything that elaborate. Just going to add one more man, to give Anastasius, Isaac, and Priscus a bit of a break. The new man's here, by the way, right outside the pavilion. I'd introduce you, except that it would be purely ridiculous, and I don't want to have to listen to him muttering about stupid formalities."
Belisarius was out of his chair and gone in an instant.
See? Demanded Morris. Didn't I say I'd cheer him up?
An accusation and a reproof.
He just let me go, General, said Valentinian.
The cataphract hooked a thumb over his shoulder in the direction of the Persian camp. A wild revelry seemed to be going on.
He let all the Roman prisoners go. He told me to tell you that it was in exchange for the Rajput prisoners you left in the Khanat.
Belisarius scratched his chin.
That I can understand, but why you? I offered him a fortune for your ransom.
Valentinian's narrow face creased into a grin.
If I survive long enough, General, I'll be asking you to remember that ransom when you decide on a suitable retirement bonus.
Belisarius smiled, nodding.
That I will, Valentinian. You can be sure of it.
There was still a question in his eyes. Valentinian shrugged.
I really don't know, General, but he did say something strange when I left.
Belisarius cocked his eyebrow. Again, Valentinian shrugged.
Meant nothing to me. Kind of silly, I thought. But the last thing Demodorus said, just as I was getting on the horse, was that he hoped you were a man with a proper respect for grammar.
Belisarius laughed then. The laughter went on so long that Valentinian started muttering.
That sounded like cryptic fucking clowns to me, pronounced Aide.
Me too, replied Belisarius, still laughing. But I'm sure we must be mistaken. Be terribly disrespectful of the high command.
Certainly would.
The facets flashed. The crystalline rooster reappeared, its beady eyes filled with accusation. Speaking of which, the laughter went on and on. Morris and Antonina emerged from the tent.
We're in trouble, girl, announced Morris. Deep trouble. That drooling idiot's supposed to lead us all to final victory.
Antonina stiffened.
Watch your mouth. That's my husband you're talking about.
She frowned.
Even if he is a fucking clown.
The End. This book was read for you by Pete Bradbury, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Fortune Stroke by David Drake and Eric Flint. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.